What a lot of people don't realize is that addiction is a disease and not a disgrace.
Multiple rehabs, multiple suicide attempts, multiple, until, there was just nothing left.
Off to the races with the drugs and the alcohol, and, any feeling that I could feel to take me out of feeling myself was really what I wanted, because I loved that feeling of not feeling.
So how did, your relationship get impacted by this recovery process? Like, how did it all start to gel together?
Labeled a slow learner.
I always felt a little bit
always
different.
Always felt like there was something wrong
I
with
was
me.
So embarrassed.
Wasn't ready to see myself.
I can't go any lower.
Don't sell yourself short.
Uncovering all those feelings.
Everything was lifted at that moment.
This really wasn't about not drinking.
Today, I would like to welcome two women who I have had the pleasure of meeting and spending time with, not only working together to help people recover from a life of addiction, but also to help an incredible institution help people. So I'm really excited today to invite Sherry and Marguerite here to Crosstalk to tell your stories.
Thanks for the opportunity.
And this is the first time we're doing a podcast with two guests, which was requested by you guys. Mm-hmm. So before we dive into your stories, I'd love to hear, a little bit about how you both grew up. Obviously, you grew up separately, but give me a brief reason why you wanted to be on camera together, why you wanted to share your stories together.
So I grew up in Central Jersey, in Woodbridge, New Jersey. And, addiction wasn't a big part in my family because I came from upper middle class family, mother and father, brother. But I had a helicopter mother. She would actually be in the next room before I even made it there. And I found that I really never was my own person. My mother would do everything for me. And it really created a feeling of insecurity within myself. So when it came time, I wanted to get out of that environment, and I was inspired, and I talk about this a lot, by a local group of baton twirlers in a parade in Woodbridge, which would allow me to take myself away from that little family, my mom, my helicopter mother. And I started baton twirling, and that was my own thing. And then I, of course, my dad was a wonderful, I was very close to my father. And my brother, I really didn't know, because when I was in fifth grade, he was in private school. So in high school, he's 4.5 years older than me. So it was very interesting that dynamic had occurred. So I really, took to the baton twirling, and fast forward, went to college. I wanted to baton twirl in college, and I did. I twirled at the University of Miami, the school where there's no drugs or alcohol. And
I love when you say that.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because, I was very naive. My weekends growing up in my high school years were baton twirling contests, weekend after weekend after weekend. And, truthfully, if I could have driven there by myself at the age of 12, I would have, but I needed a driver, so mom was with me. But she was a very irritating person. And, it was really the twirling that set me straight, that I began to enjoy and love, and I was away from, it was my own thing. And that's when I began to twirl in college, but I was introduced, to drugs, to alcohol, to Quaaludes. Oh my God, it was an experience, I can say. I'm lucky to be here.
Wow, okay. Marguerite, will you introduce yourself?
Do I do it like an AA meeting? Hi, I'm Marguerite, alcoholic. And all the rest of the addictions that kind of go along with it. It's really interesting. So I'm 74. The only reason I put that in the room is because it took me 73 years to reflect on how to really answer that question. You know, because we kind of go through the who, what, where, when, and why. But in the last 2 years, I've come to understand, you know, all the family of origin situations, all of those different things. So I'm going to try to do this without the tears.
We have tissues.
Yeah, good. That may come later.
Okay.
So I was the unwanted child. And I say that not with a sense of sadness. Not with a sense of, well, I guess there is some sadness, but I've kind of worked my way through that. So I came into this life 7 months into a marriage of two people who should never have gotten married. And this was my father, alcoholic, kind of the town, small town, you know, gigolo. And my mother, the youngest of eight brothers and sisters, and that generation, because that's the other piece of it too, that generation, you know, very stereotypic, you know, when you're getting married, when you're having the children, you know, all of those things. So in understanding that, these two people met, and I came around 7 months after they married. And so coming into the life as an unwanted child to an alcoholic father who was not present, I have three memories of him, and all of those were rooted in some sort of violence or some sort of arguments or some sort of, I just remember a lot of what I do remember, you know, that by the time of 4 years old, he was gone, kind of like a non-existent figure. And my mother, who I hated my entire life, until the age of 73 or 72, something like that, because I came to understand what that was. So all her hopes, all her dreams, all her wishes, all the things that she, all her woulda, coulda, shoulda has never happened. And so I was the recipient of the alcoholic father, abandoned, and the mother who herself was abused emotionally, physically, you know, so, and there I was. So what does that child do, only child? Well, what that child does is it survives somehow. And it survives through a world called perfection. And so the outside of me was that perfect little kid. Now, my mother's brothers and sisters actually raised me. I have no idea about my father's family. And so that child was almost like a younger brother and sister to my mother's brothers and sisters. And so I had many mothers and many fathers who taught me many different things, but no childhood friends, no typical, you know, what the storybooks, you know, the Jack and Jill storybooks back then would consider. So it was go to school, get good grades. You know, I always wanted to look perfect. You know, that outside facade of kind of things. But inside, looking back, nobody knew how sad I was because that was not allowed. It was, okay, well, you know, do your chores and get good grades and all of those things. Interestingly enough, those were survival skills that took me through all of my life, until I got to the age of 58. But there's kind of like a chapter in between. So that's a very brief fast forward till I get to 58 years old.
Okay, well, we'll definitely ask you about that.
Yeah.
So typically when we do the Crosstalk podcast, people tell us kind of like an experience, strength, and hope situation, which you both are familiar with. So kind of what happens? When did it get dark? What did that look like? And then how did you start seeing that light at the end of the tunnel? You know, were you forced to get help, or did you ask for help? So I guess we'll go from you, from the University of Miami, where they do not have any drugs or alcohol. Right. It's like a treatment center.
Right. My eyes were... I got there and I was like a kid in a candy store. I'd come from a very sheltered life because, as I said, that baton twirling, you know, helped me get through each day growing up. And I didn't start it really until I was 12 years old. So I get to Miami and I'm on my own really for the first time in my life. And it was great. It was wonderful. I could party. I could baton twirl. I had so many friends. You know, but I really had to compartmentalize because I had to maintain a cum, I had to do well in school, I had 5 hours of baton practice a day, but I was off to the races. I really was. And I ended up spending 4 years in Miami. They scouted the campus for a baton twirler for a movie down there.
Oh, wow.
There were 52 girls. My band director said, you really have to audition. I'm thinking, oh my God, a movie? Please. And I did. I auditioned for this movie that was filmed in Florida. The name of the movie was Porky's, which everyone knows that movie.
Oh my God, no!
And here I am, center stage, twirling fire in this movie. Two batons.
That's you?
Three batons.
I'm sorry. I didn't even know this about
you. Yes. Yes, and that was my claim to fame. But you know what? The drugs and alcohol really, really took off at that point. And
so what would you say were the toughest challenges for you at that? I mean, right now, were you struggling with fame? What did that look like? You say off to the races. And explain, because I don't know if people understand what that means.
Off to the races with the drugs and the alcohol. And, you know, any feeling that I could feel to take me out of feeling myself was really what I wanted, because I loved that feeling of not feeling.
Mm.
And you try and do that with two batons in your hand. It was very difficult. But I had to maintain, I managed. It was cocaine. It was a lot of everything. And my dad, who I miss terribly, and that's another piece of my story. Mm-hmm. He knew something was up and he came down there and pulled me out of college and took me back to New Jersey after the movie. So I spent 5 years in Florida, went back and went to school in New Brunswick at Rutgers, graduated from Rutgers, but I lived back in my house with my helicopter mother.
Oh God, at that age.
Which was not easy. You know, so at that point, you know, you leave somewhere, there's drugs and alcohol, you find it elsewhere. It's just a different environment. But fast forward, I graduated school, college, and I worked in special education at first.
For high school students or for...
No, actually it was K through 12, but I did special ed. And I did the homebound program for the school district where children that were cerebral palsy or couldn't get into the class, I would go ahead and whether it was thank you notes that they had to write or work with them. At that point, I knew sign language, which I really don't know anymore. But I would teach them at their homes, and it was very
amazing.
Rewarding. Yeah, it was a gift. And after, you know, of course, living back at home, just to fast forward, I was dating and I met my husband, and you know, people say to him, how did you meet? And he says, on a blind date. Boy, was I blind. You know, he jokes about that, but we're married 37 years. And from the minute we met and married, that's really when the big problem, and when I lost my dad 7 weeks after I was married.
Oh,
and I was
sorry.
Very close with him.
I'm so sorry.
I was daddy's little girl. And the problem here was I never got to say goodbye. He never woke up. So for years, I walked around with that. I felt I had that guilt, that sadness, and that I was not able to say goodbye to him. You know, I was 27 when he died, and he was 56. But there was like a piece of me that was just, I was broken. I was a broken little girl.
So you didn't get to process any of that grief?
No. Not until I went to the most incredible treatment center in the world after 12 rehab.
So now your turn. How did it all kind of start developing for you into...
You know, it's really kind of interesting because, you know, once again, that retrospective kind of thing, you know, you don't know what happened until after the fact. I call mine looking for love in all the wrong places. So, you know, here's this perfect kid trying to shield herself from the, you know, the world. I will have to say I was raised by... My mother's brothers and sisters really taught me independence in a very different way and resilience. And long before it became, you know, fashionable or whatever you want to call it, it was self-survival. But what they said is, Marguerite, always make sure that you can earn your own money, that you can be independent. I think I already was in a very different way. And their hopes and dreams for me... That's where I kind of tear up a little bit, because their hopes and dreams for me did happen eventually, but maybe not at the time during their lifetime to really kind of see it. Mm-hmm. So I did go to Westminster Choir College in Princeton. My undergrad degree was in music, performing. I think I was a natural performer as a little kid anyway, in different ways.
No baton twirling?
Baton twirling. No, mine was my voice. And so vocal major, education major, master's degree, I came from Princeton University. So I was that generation of women who were already saying, this has got to change. This has got to be very, very different.
I love that.
So everything was going along fine, except that Marguerite was looking for love in the wrong places. Finished college, drinking not a problem. Getting the master's degree, and you know, my generation was make sure that my family, you know, kind of making sure that I was the person to kind of break the mold out of that generation. So, get a teaching job, and there I met the person of what I thought was my dreams, and I met him at a party. Sounds like a theme song, at a meta party, right? And I was drunk at the time, or at least on my way to being drunk, you know, trying to be that fake, whatever you want to call it. And as it turned out, you know, he had all the credentials of somebody who needed assistance. He was going through a divorce, had two children that needed a mother, and was $30,000 in debt. Oh, perfect for somebody looking for love in the right places.
So you have the savior complex, I call it.
I didn't know it at the time. Okay. Right. But the interesting piece about it, and you know, when I often talk to young women and talk about, you know, when you're making decisions in different ways. So here was my decision. Really get involved with this man who needed, you know, a cash cow, paying $30,000 worth of debt, you know, raising two children and all of those things. Now, psychologically, you know, we've come to parse all of that apart. Or, this was the big one, or audition for the Metropolitan Opera House. So wow. I was due for an audition for the Metropolitan Opera House.
So one question, you got a master's in what?
Education.
And what Public were education. You doing at the time that you were able to pay for $30,000 worth of debt?
Well, not to begin with. Okay, you know, so he was $30,000 in debt. I was teaching. And so we actually met. He was teaching in the same school as me and just kind of looked like the, you know, the catch of my lifetime, so to speak. Okay. So.
And there. Just saying.
That's another podcast. That's another show. That's another show of a different name. Part two. Say, right. Put a pin in that one. Anyway. you know, what I mean by that, I obviously didn't have $30,000, but we had jobs, we had whatever. He was the one that had the deficit, and I looked at it as, you know, gee, you know, this is a way to, for me to kind of find love. Oh, my God. Anyway, so the drinking took off. He was an alcoholic. Mm. Okay, so alcoholic father. Alcoholic catch now at that time. My drinking takes off. And I always call this the six mistakes I made when I was dead drunk. I find out I started living with them, taking care of children, doing all of those things. And interestingly enough, I find out now that I was pregnant. And I said to him, you know, honesty was not exactly my big thing back then because I was just trying to survive. So I said to him, gee, what would it be like if, you know, would you like another child? And he said, no, I already have two children. So dead drunk, I made the decision to have an abortion and made sure that I solved the problem by having a tubal ligation so that I would never have children. Now, in retrospect, would I have done that? Would I not have done that? You know, that's, again, you know, an issue for another show, that kind of thing. But the fact that I made that decision drunk, I made that decision to find love, to have love, you know, that's, once again, you know, the sadness in all of that. You know, it wasn't made clear-headed. It wasn't made honestly. I did not say to him, I'm pregnant, you know, all these other things. So in any event, and there are more decisions that go along with that, but the world never knew. The world never knew, because the outside world knew, oh, let's see, Marguerite, singer, excellent educator, successful in, you know, career, building back from $30,000 being in debt to eventually, you know, what the world would envy as those outside material things, you know. So about the age of 20.
Picture perfect. That perfectionism kind of followed you through.
Well, it actually, it's an interesting piece because what happened was, at 26 years old, I was hospitalized for what we would call alcohol poisoning.
Oh, I've had that.
Yeah, right. but back during those days, you know, it sounds like ancient times, but back during those days, you know, although we're still far behind in kind of identifying things early enough, but I was detoxed, I guess you would say, let out of the hospital. And so at that time, he did eventually become my husband. So he and I decided, well, we're just not going to drink anymore because it's really not doing us too well. And so here was the catch. We both stopped drinking. I was 26. He was 4 years older. And then I'm going to fast forward through 30 years. So for 30 years, I was not drinking. But for 30 years,
here's, is that dry drunk?
Well,
would you call
whatever
it?
You want to call it. And, you know, they've called it dry drunk. I just called it, we weren't using, but the interesting piece about it is I never identified myself as anything else. Okay, I just didn't drink. But you know those things that I was talking about, you know, those, you know, the resentment started to build because in those 30 years, for those 30 years, you know, this audition I never went to, which I didn't think was a factor, started to become a factor. The children that I never had started to become a factor. And so on the outside, oh, and by the way, therapy, you know, any of those things to parse apart and to help me out, that's for somebody else. That
right, of course.
That wasn't for perfect over here.
And at that point, what were you still teaching or?
What happened was the outside, once again, so I was teaching. I taught for 29 years, took a break, and there's a whole story to that, got the law degree. And while I never practiced as what you would say traditional lawyers would in a firm, but I used those skills because I became an employment attorney, but managing different divisions for the New Jersey Education Association, and you know, use management skills, use the law skills for those kinds of things in union representation. So what was happening is professionally, everything looked fine.
Yeah. You know?
Marriage-wise, everything looked fine until. And I always say that be careful when a woman enters her 50s, when she enters menopause, because that pause, that pause can mean a lot of different things. And that pause for me was woulda, coulda, shoulda. And so very, you know, fast forward, I said, okay, well, miserable Marguerite, turning into the very person I swore I would never would become, which was my mother, my rage, you know, my idea of a high back then, I wasn't drinking, right? Wasn't using nothing, but my idea of a high was really cruel. I made my mother kind of look like a sweetheart at that time. You know, my idea was, let me see if I can really reduce you in some way, shape, or form, so that I could present myself as perfect.
So would you be comfortable giving us an example of that?
I don't know if there's one example of it. It was really a personality, more a personality trait. I can't think of a specific example, but it was really the way that I handled myself. I thought it was a compliment when somebody said, "I fear you." I fear you. I thought that was a compliment because it was, you're not going to get close enough to me. And it showed the world that I could kind of do anything. Mm. Yeah, right. Right. But in the meantime, and I think of all the therapy sessions, in the meantime, really what I was this little girl. Little girl. You know, I remember those early days of, you know, that psychotherapy, being reduced to really feeling like a little kid again. Yeah. You know, and having all those hurts and angers and pains and resentments, really kind of reliving through all of those things. So the fast forward story was, I did what society says, oh, you're miserable, you know, okay, time to divorce, time to sell the house, time to do all of those external kind of things. But inside, you know, just a powder keg. And then comes chapter two, as I call it, looking for love in the wrong places. And he came in the form of a very powerful attorney. You know, I'm now really so just in awe of, you know, something else. The fact that he was married was immaterial to me, you know, at that point. And, you know, there's a whole story that goes along with that. Now, here's the interesting piece. As the unidentified alcoholic, right, not thinking that it was a problem and wanting to put on a facade, I'm now at the Nassau Inn, right, in Princeton, New Jersey, and having a wonderful date, and he says to me, would you like to have a glass of wine? I said, absolutely. And had a wonderful glass of Pinot Noir. And the date was February the 1st, 2008, and 11 days later, I wind up at the Virtual Hospital in Marlton, New Jersey, with a blood alcohol 0.425. Now, the reason I say that, yeah, I don't say it because, you know, in drunkologs and those things, like, everybody gets impressed some way in a very false way. How much did you use? I just say that now in the sense of I should not be alive.
Well, I also think that it sounds like in less than a month.
11 days.
Yeah, in 11 days.
You went from 0 to 60.
Yeah.
And that's like not a normal behavior, right? Like that's not what a normal person does after one glass of Pinot Noir, right?
Well, what happened was, I had that fancy glass of Pinot Noir, and literally 24 hours later, I was standing outside of Gennardi's supermarket in Marlton, New Jersey, waiting for the doors to open up so that I could go in at 5 o'clock in the morning. Now, I paused there because, right, perfection. I mean, you know, I look back at it and say, who was that? Mm-hmm. I can also say, thank God it happened. In some strange way, thank God it happened, because it prevented this.
Yeah.
And, you know, the interesting piece about this is, and I don't even know where we go from here, but, you know, when you learn, your wounds become your gifts.
Yeah.
When you're taught that. Short piece of this is, we met in rehab, but not exactly at the same time. We had the open door policy. That's the only thing I could say. So I was in rehab and heard about this, or experienced this phenomenal speaker coming in one Wednesday evening when we had a women's meeting, and her name was Sherry Belkoff. Mm-hmm. And I think I was, this may have been the second time that I was, and by the way, you know, multiple relapses, multiple recurrences, and each more deadly than the other. You know, and I always say, if my life depended on, you know, if I ever had to testify, what did you do during those 2 years? I really couldn't day to day, month by month, tell you exactly what happened, except that it was multiple rehabs, multiple suicide attempts, multiple, until, mm-hmm. until, you know, there was just nothing left. So I get into primary care, it's called back then, And one Wednesday evening, there was this wonderful speaker. Her name was Sherry Belkoff. Said that already. But and I wanted all the rest of the women to hear this phenomenal speaker by the name of Sherry Belkoff. And because I had heard her, and I said, wow, what an incredible story, and all of those things. And so I'm waiting for Sherry Belkoff with the rest of the women, and no Sherry Belkoff appears at that meeting. And?
Because Sherry Belkoff was back in detox. I entered back in, Karen, for my last and final gig, I should say, in April of 2008. And when I was supposed to be speaking to the women on campus, I was in detox. So I went back in on the evening that I, because of a relapse, a very quick.
How long had you been sober?
3 years.
Okay.
But there was something that wasn't working.
Right.
I was working a program, so I thought, but not to my best. I should not really working it, but not working it, you know, because it doesn't matter what substance you use. If you use, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Plain old English.
Right.
And I had a legitimate reason to, I say relapse. It was a relapse on pills. I had shingles in my ear. Painful.
Wow.
But there's only one thing I forgot to tell the doctor, that I was in recovery. Oh. So I still had that shame inside of me. You know, it still was that stigma that today, honey, I'll go, wow. I wear recovery all over.
I hope so, because you know? Guys, this is on YouTube.
Oh, but just don't so you
just
worry.
So you know.
I hope everyone is listening you know. To us.
And the release is the cameras, right? So if you walk in the door and you see these cameras, that's the release you sign that you're okay
damn
with
right.
it.
Let me just say this. I have been in every form you could possibly imagine. And I've said this publicly and it's been recorded. The greatest degree I have ever gotten, the greatest experience I have ever been through is where we are right now, which is to say I have a disease called, happens to be alcoholism.
Yeah.
But more importantly, this is what recovery is all about.
I agree. I think it takes the power away from it. I tell people, every people in my building, they're like,
"Yeah,
you have a podcast. What's it about?" And I say recovery, and they're like, they're confused. You know, they're just like, "You're so strong for telling us." And I'm like,
"Well,
yeah.
what a lot of people don't realize." Is that addiction is a disease and not a disgrace. And I always say that, and I take that from Linda Caron. She says that all the time.
And family said that.
Absolutely, families, it's.
You know, the interesting piece about all of this, and we could keep going back and forth. I mean, the stories behind the two of us, how we met, and I call it, you know, the circling door of in, out, but the bottom line is that what's happened since really 2009, 2010, because we went from patients to being volunteers to doing everything. Our common bond is the work that we've done, not only personally with each other, but also in recovery.
Yeah.
And in, you know, when the phrase of paying it forward, I don't even think of it paying it forward. Oh. I just kind of thinking of it as the gift of life.
Agreed.
The gift of life to be able to do all these things. And as far as the two of us are concerned, I think we should be a commercial message of some sort, because not only do we have people around us saying, how did you meet, you know, because they'll
right.
overhear us. But we say, and I mean, we did it here, which is we met in rehab.
Mm-hmm.
And while others might think, oh, that's an awful place to meet, that's the best place to meet. You couldn't be any more real. You know, it's a common bond of people struggling and saying, what is this? What is it that I have? Because for me, while the use was just unspeakable and took me into the darkest places and life-threatening places, for me, what it did is, how I started this out, what it eventually did is, through all the psychotherapy, through mm-hmm. all of the process itself, oh, that was the little girl who never had the chance to be a little girl. Oh, wait, that mother I hated? How could she? I came to understand that her life was sacrificed in some way for me. And I was able to come to understand that's all she could be, because she, although she gave me the gift of life, she did not have that gift of what I went through in learning what her hurts, her angers, her pains were, her rages were all about. So it's interesting because through her entire life and my entire life, I came to understand mine a whole lot better. Now, here I am at this age and saying, I just feel like a teenager again, like, you know, can I please live forever? Silly request. But because it's like learning how to really live life fully through recovery and have a sister in a great way.
But I think also, you know, you made that drunk decision when you were younger, right? To not have not be able to have children, and you have become, I mean, I don't look at you as well, but a guiding force for women like me who are, look up to you. I look at you and I say, wow, this woman is, I'm like gonna cry, what's happening? But you're a force, you're successful. You walk into a, you sit on the major board of trustees. I'm just an advisory board member.
Oh, never say just.
No.
Okay, but you know, you walk in and we are women in a room of white men.
Yep.
And how cool is it that you guys have such a strong voice and have guided women like me who, I mean, not only are you successful in business, in life, in everything, and you're successful as a mother, as a member of society, helping all these people. To me, that is like you've arrived, you know? And maybe I shouldn't say that, and those words are very contentious in recovery, but I'm like, I want what they have.
You know what? Thank you for saying that, but
not to blow up. I don't want you to fly away, you know. No,
no. You know, it's, I always say that I didn't have to do the tough work of child raising, you know, the diapering and all of those things. But there are many women and men, young men, that have become sons and daughters and all of those things. So this whole process of recovery, unspeakably wonderful gifts, you know, in so many different ways.
You know, I have to say, and I'm going to jump back for a moment. I was on the verge of losing my family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I went, I am a product, and I say that, of 12 rehabs prior to going to Karen Treatment Centers. And it was there that I understood and began to understand that I didn't have to be ashamed of my disease, that it's a disease, and it could, and it's a disease and it could be arrested. And it was really there that I began to identify of who I am and that I didn't have to be ashamed and I could get better.
Yeah.
I could heal. My family could heal. And that's exactly what we did together. My children hated me. They couldn't wait for me to go back to treatment so there would be no chaos in their home.
And what's wonderful now is to be the aunt, the crazy aunt to all of that, and watching, say, how can I do this without crying? And watching Sherry and Larry, her husband, and Andy and Emily and Josh and their spouses, soon to be spouses or whatever else you want to call it and everything else. And to watch, what's wonderful for me is to watch And to see that family become everything that you read about, that you read about, you know, when they say, you know, how to rebuild, how to do all those things. And this is what's very interesting about this dynamic is, for me, watching that all happen and come together. And, you know, the process behind it, you know, so Sherry gets sober, but that doesn't mean everything is all better, right? To watch that family drill down and work individually, collectively, to continue, you know, in different ways. For me, I made a very different decision. My decision was to remove myself from what happened with the stepchildren that I raised. They had six grandchildren. To watch, you know, I ended a marriage because, in my particular instance, unlike, you know, what happened with all the Belkoffs, it was going to be a situation where my husband, then became ex-husband, said, "You're the problem. We don't need any help."
So they didn't want to participate in recovery, and they didn't feel like they had a part in this.
Right. And this is one of the decisions I speak about all the time, you know, because so many women in particular, I see, maybe men in a very different way, men more that I have dealt with, you know, not a good way of putting it, but that I've, you know, in speaking or in doing all the volunteer work, they're kind of, yes, they want to maybe rebuild family, but, you know, more goal-oriented, more professionally oriented. Yeah. I always say to women, hello, you know, where's your professional career, you know, those kinds of things. But having said that, I don't know how many women will say, I need to get out of rehab or I need to get out of treatment because I need to go back to my family. And I'm saying that's the last place you need to be.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. You are not capable of being able to do this in different ways. So there's this instinct, go back, go rebuild and do all of those things with really, you know, just more heart and will than, you know, skills in different ways. And I said, there may be this point where you are going to have to make this difficult challenge. You know, when they say your recovery comes first, because it does, it does.
It has to.
It is a non-negotiable factor. And I pause there because, you know, let me just kind of like underscore it. It's a non-negotiable thing, you know, abstinence, sobriety, whatever you want to call it. Because it will determine the rest of your life and the quality of the rest of your life and making decisions. And for me, the decision was I could either spend the rest of my life chasing after people who were not going to work their own program, heal themselves, understand that we could in fact rebuild a family.
How your family wanted you to go back into deep, get away.
Yeah, they hated my guts. You know, here I am growing up in this, married, three children, you know, nice area in Pennsylvania, Lafayette Hill, on a cul-de-sac. My kids witnessed a lot. And, you know, they witnessed their mom being 302'd off of the front lawn with all of the neighbors watching. And
so wait, tell everybody what a 302 is, because not everyone's from Pennsylvania.
So a 302 is when the police are called and they come and take you to a mental institution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, I had all the neighbors watching this. And I have to say this, because this is important. All the neighbors, all the people in the town that used to talk about me behind my back are the ones that come to me today for advice about their loved ones and how can they get them into treatment, because you know this affects someone you know, whether it's a spouse, whether it's an aunt, an uncle, a friend, a cousin, it affects everyone. Addiction, you know, mental illness. And I tried back and forth and in and out. And as I said, it wasn't until I went to Karen, and that was my last stop after the relapse of the shingles in my ear, and I couldn't take pain medicine, and I had to. And I've been sober ever since, but my children have had a tremendous amount of therapy. My husband, who's a physician, thank God, understands addiction as a disease, because I was in treatment with people that went ahead and were served divorce papers while they're there. And that's got to be the most difficult thing. I couldn't even understand that, you know, to go through something like that. And I have to say, today I have a very supportive family. Marguerite is part of our family. We have a group text that includes our family member, Marguerite, which is just amazing. My one daughter, and I have to say this, Josh was probably the least affected. He went off to college and he was away when, but of course still home later in a little bit of his life. But he went off to college and he's the one that we thought, he slept next to my husband on the floor until he was 13 years old. Uh-huh. Because mom was constantly in and out of treatment. Uh-huh. My kids were raised by housekeepers. And even though I felt I really wasn't there, when I was there, but I wasn't. If that makes any sense to you.
It does, actually. It really does.
You know, I was a good mom. I wasn't a well mom. And there's a difference. You know, I could be a better mom. And I became the best version of myself after I got sober. Emily was my child that was extremely difficult, tomboy, who is my easiest child today, you know. My youngest, the interesting part of this piece, she ended up going to medical school. And the rotation that she dreaded in med school was psychiatry, because it would bring up a lot of different feelings for her. And believe it or not, it's the field that she fell in love with, the rotation. And I'm happy to say she's in her first year of fellowship in child and adolescent psychiatry.
Oh, amazing.
So she wants to help the children that go through situations that she went through growing up.
Because she can relate and understand. And I think
they make the best psychiatrists. Yeah.
Yeah. The power of being able to relate to your clientele, I think, is incredible. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why our roles in the recovery community are important, because people can be like, oh, okay, you got through it, you know, and you are successful, and you're a successful mother, and I'm a successful crazy aunt, you know, and we guide and help people in the community. Now, tell me more about how did your relationship, so you said that you were supposed to see this speaker who didn't show up. You happened to be in detox. So this is the first kind of rotation. So how did, you know, your relationship get impacted by this recovery process? Like, how did it all start to gel together?
So I was in chapel one day up at Karen getting my 1 year coin. And I walked in and I saw Marguerite sitting there with a whole row of people and her family. And I said, how nice. She brought them up, you know, for chapel. Marguerite was a patient again. Okay. I didn't know that.
You know, the interesting thing is, I don't know if there was a next step. I can't say I left rehab and then Sherry and I started to communicate. I'm not exactly sure how we reconnected. I think, you know, the connection was always there with the in out of, you know, the revolving door of rehab and all of those. But we started, the process was that we volunteered. Mm-hmm. And, you know, while we're always told, you know, give back, be of service, work programs, work all of those things, it was almost like an organic thing.
You're right.
So we had the in-out of rehab, and then we somehow, through our volunteer work, kept the connection going. And so Sherry continues her personal journey, rebuilding the family. Mm-hmm. I continued my personal journey, whatever it may be. And the connection really was because of Karen.
Yes.
And would you say that you connect more and help more like families and moms, and you connect and help like just women in general? Or is there a specific population you get drawn to? Or
no.
Not at all.
Not at all. That's what's interesting about the process, because, and I'll just speak for myself, I just look at it in terms of watching another person suffer. Mm. You know, and the interesting piece is, you know, not even understanding that there's them not even understanding that they're really suffering, because, you know, the denial, the wanting to keep everybody away from themselves. And I have to tell you, you know, it's like you see yourself, you go back, it's like a flashback, you go back and you see yourself and say, oh, that's what that is. Oh, that's what that is. Oh, that's what it looks like. Oh my God, that's what I was like.
I think that's also why they say give back, because I feel as though when I'm giving back, I'm almost like learning even more about myself, and at the same time, like reiterating recovery and how important it is to stay on the beam, as they say, you know, to not, I'm like, oh, I don't want to go through that again. I don't want to be that nasty person again. I don't want to be, you know, hurting people left and right.
You know what else is interesting? When you do the consistent volunteer work, especially there, what I find myself experiencing is really many of the same things that families go through. It's like when I see a patient come back again and back again and back again, I'm saying, oh, that's what the family feels like. What are you going to get this? You know, I say, whoa, you know, so.
But the phenomenal, back then we had a great family education program. My children were in that family education program and the children's program. And by the time they came up to visit and really didn't want to look at me, and then when they were finished that particular day, they said, Mom, we're understanding, you know. And that's a very key component to understand that you're not a bad person. My mom's a sick person. She's not a bad person, you know. And today, my kids don't leave me alone. And I'm telling you, it is a wonderful, wonderful feeling. It is, because, you know, I'm involved in their lives. And to a certain extent, I have one married, two that are not, one that is very serious with a girl whom I love. But I take a step back. I really do, because I have boundaries today.
Right.
You know, I never had any boundaries before. Today I have boundaries, you know.
So tell me a little bit about, you know, what was early recovery like, right? So you guys had this kind of revolving door. I always like to ask people kind of, you know, what do you think was helpful for you when you first were getting it?
So it's interesting, because, you know, I was still, when I was newly sober, you know, I went to AA, okay, but I can't be seen. I don't want my friends to know I'm there, or my neighbors. I drove an hour from my first AA meeting to Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Oh, wow.
I walked into that church and I saw two people I knew.
That's so
and
funny.
I, at that point, said to myself, damn, I'm not alone. I walked back into my local group, and I saw about eight people I knew. Till this day, that is still my home group. I love mentoring individuals that come to me. I'm a 12-step contact for Karen. When people get out that are in my area, you know, I speak openly about my recovery today, because I always was a firm believer. It's your secrets that keep you sick. So I am out there. And for me, that has made me a better person inside and outside. So
I guess mine was opposite. I didn't want to die. And it was a question that was posed to me by one of the therapists. Actually, I don't know if it was a question. It was more like, you're on the verge here, Marguerite. You know, there were too many times people already pumping on my chest. And, you know, it was interesting. It certainly wasn't the Bill Wilson burning bush. I'm often asked, when did you know you got it? You know, it wasn't any of those things. In retrospect, it was a lot of those things.
Right.
You know, life is, lessons are learned in retrospect. But what it really was, I just didn't want to die. And really was very fortunate that I was able to just very slowly, and I can't say I sat there and, oh yes, I'm going to take all the lessons I learned and go to all the meetings and do all those things. This is how I've learned that my life really is a gift, because I just sat in meetings, I listened, did I follow instructions? Did I consciously follow instructions? I don't know if I did or I didn't. It's right. Just, you know, kind of practicing it, living literally every single day. And that was, let's see, 2009. He is no longer with us, but a great spiritual force said, Margaret, you've been in and out of treatment so many different times. You want to pick a sobriety date? So I picked December the 25th. Seriously. So I picked December 25th because it just sounded like a day that everybody would.
Day.
Yeah, there we go. You see?
Wow. That's my day.
So December 25th of 2009, you know, there are some people who count hours and days or whatever, but that just seems to be a good day. The other piece about it, and I think that this was the secret. So there, I call it part A, part B. So part A was the sobriety piece. But the part B, really, the recovery piece started when I went through a program called Breakthrough. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to call it finishing school, you know, rehab is undergrad and Breakthrough is grad school or whatever else it is.
I've been dying to do this program. Yeah, so I can't wait to hear this part.
You know, look, there aren't too many programs that are similar to it. You know, there's on-site, there's, you know, you can name a few, but really for me, while the alcoholism, and that really was the primary drug. Of course, you know, you find out there were other drugs, behaviors, and, you know, perfection, and all that other kind of stuff. But really, for me, it was getting to the what's really cooking in here, the why.
Yeah.
The why, not the what. The what was the drug, the why. Mm. And the why was learning all these pieces for me. And when I see someone really struggling, you know, that repeat, you know, in and out of rehabs, in and out of recurrences, in and out of those things, it's, you know, of course, everybody has their own journey. It's getting to the why of it, because why am I like this? Why is this happening? And there are places to be able to really discover, but, and that's hard work.
Oh,
that's
God.
As hard, if not harder, than getting that sobriety piece. You know, that's a practice. But for me, when I got the why, it was probably the best gift, because now my behaviors, my relapses, if you want to call it that, were not, it's not about the drug. It's about that behavior of, Marguerite, draw back. Or that's what is, you know, when I call it, when that little piece of me goes looking for love in the wrong places, draw it right back. Why? There it is, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, it's, there it is.
Yeah.
Breakthrough is an incredible program. I went through it myself. And, you know, you dig deep, you bring out your resentments, and you go through every nook and cranny of your life, you know, and that helped me. In fact, when I got done with the Breakthrough 5-day program, I didn't talk on my phone for 2 days.
Wow.
I remember driving from Warnersville, Pennsylvania to Margate, New Jersey, because I was going down the shore. Uh-huh. I didn't speak to anyone for 2 days.
Wow.
I was just taking it all in. I couldn't speak.
So it was just you processing
Everything.
It's so funny you say the why, because my second day in treatment, I turned around to my therapist and I said, well, I don't understand why. And he goes, does it matter why? You just do the behavior. And I think that's what I needed to hear then, for sure. But now I'm approaching 8 years of sobriety, and there are things. And there are behaviors that are repeated. And I think that this, a lot of people speak to this, you know, about certain behaviors that are repeated, like the looking for love in the wrong place, or the running away, or the this or the that. And it's like, the why piece. Like, what, why do I do that?
You know, the interesting piece here, and I go back to my story and thinking, you know, there's a lot of things that all of a sudden come up. Oh, I remember that. Oh, yeah. I remember that. Drugs and alcohol are not the only part of my story.
Mm.
Okay. Gambling was a huge part. I would run away to casinos and blackjack tables for 2 days at a time. Who does that in their
right
mind?
Wow, really?
Okay, gambling, smoking, cigarettes.
Me too.
Drugs, alcohol, eating disorder. I think the only one I missed was sex and love addiction. It's true, okay? So, you know, it was...
We got that covered.
Yeah, yeah. I could run to anything and become addicted to it.
Right.
But I would leave my family for 4 or 5 days at a time with one in diapers. How, who in their right mind does that?
That was when you were drinking,
yes,
though, as well.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. But, you know, you talk about the craziness of this disease.
Insanity.
It's completely, completely insane. Today, I don't have to do that. But, you know, Marguerite touched on a point. She didn't want to die. I have an issue. I fear death. And I know that I'm not the only one because many people do.
I have a
book
for you.
I want the book.
I have it right
okay.
here.
I didn't want to die, but there was an ultimatum. And my husband had put, I had put my children through way too much of my family and myself.
Yeah.
And I really didn't want to die. And when he said to me, for my last time going to treatment, he says, I can't do this to the kids anymore. They can't take this anymore. He said, I can't take this anymore. And something stuck, and I didn't want to die. Mm-hmm. And today I'm able to sit here and be proud of all the hard work that I put into my recovery, continuing every day.
Yeah.
You know.
You know, what you just said, it's really interesting because so many men and women want to run back to their families. You know, they're mm-hmm. getting treatment and... don't want to spend the time, don't want to, you know, need to get
my
back.
My kids need me.
My kids need me. And
they
the interesting
need you. They don't need that you.
Well, no. The interesting piece about it, and I see it all the time, and I often say it, it's not necessarily gentlest thing to say, but there's an example of it. Sherry spent the time and continues. And by the way, that's the other piece of it too. You know, what's great about it is it's you learn a new skill every day. It continues in so many different ways. But there are so many men and women, primarily women, that want to get back home, want to get back. And it's no going. It's and they take unhealed selves back right. to a situation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I often say to them, you are going to see your hurts, angers and pains, and you're going to see it in the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it will, you know, you've got the time now to shift, to shift the coming generations. So
I think that's so profound because I'm not a mother, right? But I meet a lot of mothers that come through treatment and I say to them, like, don't go yet, because I've worked with women who are mothers and they took the time mm-hmm. and now they've had their kids and they don't keep going in and out, right? Other women I know who run back home, come back again. Wouldn't you rather be gone for a few months and heal, as you're saying, rather than be in and out like the revolving door, you know, like
absolutely.
Take the time. But, you know, I think that my father was diagnosed with prostate cancer when I got into treatment. And I said, oh my God, I have to go home and be there.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, they don't want you there. And that's not what my parents said. And my parents were resentful that they said that to me. But it was important for me to hear that and understand that they don't want this Irene there. It's not that they don't want me there. They love me. But they want a healed Irene. How can I help him when I'm a freaking mess? I think your bond has changed your recovery. Or impacted your recovery.
I never thought about that
one either.
Thank you. You just gave me something to think about.
Thank you, Sergio.
We have no secrets with one another. We are just, I feel like Marguerite's been my been with me for my life. And it's just, it's fascinating, because when you go through and experience so much together, and, you know, not all good. We went through a lot of shit together, you know? But it brings you on the other side of just so much immense gratitude for each other.
Some advice to give someone who's struggling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Never give up.
Never give up.
Never give up. Because when you think you can't do this, you can. Mm. You can. You put one step in front of the other, and sometimes one second at a time, but keep going, because it is a dream. It is a life. And I know it's a cliche, but it is a life beyond my wildest dreams.
Oh my God.
And a true gift.
I love that. And tell me what you think that you would tell someone struggling.
Use your voice and say help.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because there is help.
Oh yeah.
Whatever it may be. It may not be the help that you need at that moment or whatever else, but using your voice in the way to just say help. Help me. And just by saying that aloud, if nothing else, to yourself. Mm. You know, that cry, that inner cry of help. You know, it will come running in some way.
Yeah.
You know, or run towards help.
I love that. I love that.
There is such a bright light at the end of the tunnel. Don't give up.
I love that. Thank you. And every episode I ask this question, so we'll kind of come to the end of it. And I ask, if you can go back and tell your younger self something, how old would you be? And what would you say? If you can picture that younger self.
Oh, I know where I am.
Okay.
Oh, I just thought about this. Your dreams can come true. Maybe not the way that you think.
Hmm.
And I think that I would say, you know, going back.
How old?
Maybe 9, 10. Okay. Life doesn't have to be perfect. There's no such thing as perfect. It's okay to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's okay to grow from them.
I love it. Thank you guys for coming.
Amazing. Amazing.
I wish everybody, and I hope it comes through in the podcast, but you guys have such good energy. I mean, like, I believe that everything is energy scientifically, yeah. But we're made up of water, right? So yes. Our sounds, our voices reverberate within us and create almost a vibration. And when I'm with you two, I feel like the vibration is harmonious.
Thank you. It's really been a pleasure and a gift to be able to do this.
Thank you.